sounding the alarm. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a nice weekend. Just ahead, we touch base with the Dolores Barweaver Policy Center and their new report, helping to reform the juvenile justice system for African-American girls. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, how you can make your voice heard this week when it comes to the controversial process of changing the names of some local schools. Names with ties to the old Confederacy. That's later. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reports that cases around Florida increased over the weekend by nearly 3,700. The cumulative total stands at 1.97 million. Hospitalizations keep ticking down. That's good news. But deaths rose again. The death tally in the state now stands at 32,255. And nearly 4.2 million Floridians have had at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine. Speaking of vaccines, as of today, if you are age 60 and up, you are now eligible to receive the coronavirus vaccine in Florida. Again, let me say that again. As of today, if you are 60 and older, you can get the vaccine. So find the nearest vaccine site and get that shot if you're 60 or older. All right, now on to our lead story. New research conducted by the Dolores Barweaver Policy Center out this week finds that Black girls in the state are disproportionately punished at nearly every point in the education and juvenile justice systems. These findings are relevant, the center says, to bringing forth overdue reforms needed to support the well-being of girls and young women. We're pleased to welcome Dr. LaWanda Rivora, President Emeritus of the Dolores Barweaver Policy Center. Dr. Rivora, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Also on the line, Dr. Vanessa Patino-Lydia, Vice President of Research and Planning, and the lead researcher on the report. Hi, Dr. Lydia.
Good morning.
Good to have you both. It's 549-2937. Give us a call here on First Coast Connect. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. By the way, my laptop just died. I might not be able to read your tweets for a minute or two. I'm going to try to get this rebooted. And emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. All right. In a moment, we'll go to Dr. Patino-Lydia. But Dr. Rivora, let's begin with you. The Dolores Barweaver Policy Center is just an amazing organization as you advocate for young women and girls in this state and really across the country and call for reforms to the criminal justice system. Tell us about this new study. It's called Sounding the Alarm, the Criminalization of Black Girls in Florida. You made a special focus on Black girls. Tell me about that.
Thank you for the opportunity, Melissa. Yes, the Policy Center has been following trends for some time now, really looking at what's been happening over not just 1 year, but over a decade. And as you shared in your opening, there are some alarming statistics that we're really seeing that call for statewide attention to bring about reform. And of particular note is the disparities that are happening at every point in the system, whether we're looking at school suspension all the way to arrest and incarceration. There are disparities at every point in that system.
At every point in that system. So, Dr. Lydia, here are some numbers you found. It begins at school. Black girls account for about half of girls suspended from school in Florida, correct?
Correct.
And that's highly disproportionate.
That is disproportionate because in Florida, Black girls represent about 1 in 5 girls, 21% of the general population.
So tell me more about that. What you're saying in this study is that Black girls are more likely to be suspended, more likely to be tipped into the criminal justice system, sometimes for minor offenses that white girls might not receive the same punitive response. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. So one of the things that we found three critical findings from the research, because we really wanted to identify the points along the way where decisions get made, where those interactions are happening that lead to those outcomes, those larger disparate outcomes where we start to see that half of the girls in the juvenile justice system are Black girls. When if things were equitable, we would expect that one in five of the girls who are in the juvenile justice system were Black girls, because that would be representative of the population. And we found that school is a major, major entry point into the system for girls. And there are a lot of research to suggest that suspension itself, being, you know, excluded from school and being pulled out of the school and experiencing that school disconnect, is also related to being arrested. But that is also happening. So, you know, if there are fights that happen in school, often law enforcement or school resource officers are called into the schools, and girls are getting charges for that. They're getting arrested. And so what we found is that of all of those incidents, those initial contacts with law enforcement that were happening in school, almost 50%, it was 49% of the girls, 49% of the Black girls, or 49% of the girls, of the girls were Black that came in contact with law enforcement at school. And of these, one in four resulted in an arrest when they would have been eligible for like a less serious penalty, like a civil citation, because it was their first time. And even more interestingly is what we're finding that is aligned with the research is this concept of adultification, where younger Black girls are being pulled into the system differently than their peers.
5492937. Dr. Rivora, let's talk about civil citations. Your organization has really advocated for not just girls, but all teens rather than be entering into the criminal justice system for a minor offense, to be instead issued a civil citation. Can you explain why that's so important?
Well, first, I want to acknowledge that in Northeast Florida, our circuit has increased the use of civil citations, and are a district that I would hope that the rest of Florida would follow. It's so important because that first contact is an opportunity to divert a young person from going deeper into the justice system. And we can divert them into services that are really aligned with meeting their need. And when we do that, we have the opportunity of putting them on a track toward addressing what's driving the behavior. And particularly for girls, it's trauma, it's victimization, it's exploitation. There's things that are going on in their lives as children to address instead of pushing them deeper into the criminal justice system, which we know has long-term impact on their future.
Right. And once a child, a teen, or a young adult, once they enter what you call the school-to-prison pipeline, it's very hard to get them out, isn't it?
It is. I had a mother tell me one time that she was just so panicked because her daughter had made a mistake. She was now caught up and trapped in this justice system, and it becomes almost impossible to get out. And what happens for girls, we start to see that they are over-monitored. And oftentimes, behaviors that are just teenage acting out behaviors, out-of-bounds behaviors, start to then push them deeper in. They're placed on probation, so they're monitored. If they miss a curfew, if they, act out in school, some of the things that we often did, because they're under such scrutiny, they can have a technical violation of probation that then gets them in a detention center, that then gets them in a residential lockup facility. So it starts to snowball and just escalate, and we have an opportunity with civil citations to divert them from ever entering the justice system, and that's where our priorities should be.
Now, let me ask you, Vanessa, you find that 10 Florida counties have particularly high overrepresentation of Black girls in juvenile arrests and incarceration, and Duval County, according to the statistics you've provided, tops that list. So is it accurate to say that Duval County is arresting and incarcerating more teenage girls who are African-American than any other Florida county. That's what I, it seems to be either that or Broward County, according to your numbers.
So it's not so much that Duval tops the list, but it is one of the 15 counties on the list that shows that based on the numbers, based on the general population, that black girls are being arrested and incarcerated at greater rates. So specifically in Duval County, black girls represent 43% of the general population, but they represent 67% of the girls who were arrested last year. They represent 64% of the girls who were committed last year. And more specifically, of the girls who were 12 years old or younger who were arrested, black girls represented 75% of that cohort in Duval County.
In a moment, we'll go to the recommendations in this report. But first, let's go to your calls, 549-2937. Give us a call. John on the South Side. Hi, John. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Melissa. Good morning, NPR audience. My statement in question is, again, we have noticed these as generational problems in America, all across the country, especially Duval County. I've commented a few times on how to help the kids stay out of the system. But as we so readily say now, school, prison, the pipeline. I mean, that is a terrible thing to be able to say and prove. What is happening is this. Our system is generated by profit. So if I could create criminals at a younger age, then what that means? 10 years from now, my prisons will be filled. And I can make money. So what they're doing, just like when we went to school, if we got in a fight or something, hey, they broke it up, they called your parents, they shut you down, they talked with you, you know, and they did preventive measures. Well, in the past 15 to 20 years here in America, those type of offenses is crimes now. Okay, and so you got to think. If you're taking a young child, okay, some things could be happening in the home that are causing acting out. Now, you take a young child and you say, oh, well, they are 12 years old. You know, they know exactly what they're doing. And then you charge them as an adult. You put them in the system. The system is designed to keep you in it. It's not designed to rehabilitate you. The moment the United States government went from state prison system and rehabilitation, this is when you started seeing these types of trends. So that is really the problem. We got to take out the for-profit penal system. We got to do it because everything in America is about capitalism. They capitalize off their grandma. So now we capitalize off teenage behavior that everybody in America don't went through.
All right, John. All right, yeah. Thank you, John. Dr. Rivora, certainly Florida has a number of for-profit prisons. In a moment, we'll get to the policy recommendations you have in this report, but what about that? Do private prisons need to be part of the solution, phasing them out?
I think that we have to look at reform overall, and the proliferation of private prisons is certainly a major issue of concern. And I would say for our young people, and particularly for girls, they don't need to be in these residential lockup facilities. They are not a threat to the community. And there are community-based options where we know are effective in addressing the trauma, in addressing the fractured families that are resulting in out-of-bounds behavior. And so there is definitely an opportunity to shift the funds that are going into all prisons, and including private prisons, to community-based options where we provide the treatment and the family intervention services that are desperately needed.
All right. So then, Vanessa, tell us what you're recommending. You are calling for immediate action, by the way, on a number of issues throughout the state's juvenile justice system. What are they?
We are calling for immediate policy changes, starting with the schools, banning the suspension of pre-K to third grade students. And this is aligned with what other states and jurisdictions are doing across the country, and is developmentally appropriate. We are calling for setting limits on the age of arrest. Florida currently does not set an age limit. 27 other states have set that limit, and we are calling to set that limit at the age of 12 for children in Florida. And just to the caller's point, last year, the youngest girl arrested in Florida was a six-year-old black girl. And a seven-year-old black girl.
Wait a minute. A
felony offense.
What was a six-year-old arrested for?
An incident at school that happened in the principal's office. It actually made national headlines.
Let's go over that. I remember that. Tell us what happened. Tell us again that incident, if you could.
I don't remember all the details. I know that police were called. This was in Osceola County, I believe, just outside of Orlando. There was an incident in the principal's office. Police were called to help de-escalate, and she was taken in the police car. And I think at that point, her parents were notified. It made national headlines. And actually, last year there was the call for the Kaya Roll Act to be passed in legislation, which sets the limit on age 7, I believe, or age 10 initially. Not allowing children to be arrested, as well as setting protocols between law enforcement, school resource officers, and the schools about which incidents need to be handled by the school.
It's just amazing to me that we have to ask for this, Dr. Revor, that you have to say we shouldn't be arresting little kids.
I absolutely agree. These are children in crisis. And as adults, we have a ethical responsibility to recognize when a child is in crisis and to, rather than pushing them out, to wrap our arms around them and provide them with the services and supports that they need to address what's going on in their lives. And behind every one of these statistics that Vanessa is talking about is a child. And we as adults are supposed to provide the safe spaces for our children to grow and to thrive. And this report is really calling for these immediate actions so that we can shift our response from one of push out to one of providing spaces for healing, spaces for our children to grow, and the very thing that we would want for our own children.
The report is out this week. Vanessa, how can people access the report, first off?
The report is available on our website, www.seethegirl.org/soundingthealarm. You can download the executive summary and the full report. And we hope that people will read it, share it. There's lots of ways to get involved, learn what's happening in the schools with different policies and practices, follow us in terms of the advocacy for public policy, and learn more about the legislative work that is happening on behalf of children in the state of Florida.
Yeah, and so, Dr. Revor, there is a legislative session going on right now. Once the report is out and people can read it, how do you plan then to take your advocacy to people who can actually make some changes?
Well, we absolutely have already made this report available to the members of our First Coast delegation. We will make it available to the executive branch as well. And we are asking for there are two levels in terms of how we can bring about reform, beginning at the state level, but it's the local level where we can ban suspension of children pre-K to third grade. That can be done by our local school boards. So some of this will require, and we are continuing to call for use of civil citations so that we stop at the very beginning our children getting caught up and trapped in the juvenile justice system. But at the state level, we certainly will be advocating for increased funding for mental health services that can be provided at the community as well as in the school, and to fund community-based alternatives to incarceration or detention so that we keep our children out of the justice system. But more importantly, we provide the interventions and the therapeutic supports that they need to address what's going on in their lives.
Thank you both so much for being with us, Dr. LaWanda Rivora and Vanessa Patino-Lydia, both with the Dolores Barr Weaver Policy Center, more at seethegirl.org. Ladies, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, how you can be part of the process to change names of local schools. We'll tell you about that. And also a new rooftop dining opportunity opening up downtown. That's all later, but up next.
This latest study out of England at Moorfields Hospital has used artificial intelligence as a way to predict which patients are more likely to develop this problem.
How artificial intelligence could save your precious sight. We'll be right back.
Best music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Tune in to 89.9 HD3, the WJCT app, or jacksmusic.org. We've got your music on Anthology on 89.9 HD3.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jacksbundle.com. Start watching today.
For some young black women, life in Louisville has been difficult in the year since police shot and killed Breonna Taylor.
It just makes me feel like no matter what I do, even if I'm in the comfort of my own house, I'm just minding my business. Like, I'm not safe from being killed.
How those women are confronting that fear on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow, starting at 5 on WJCT News 89.9.
Up to 1 million Syrian refugees have fled their country's war over the past decade and sought refuge in Lebanon, the much smaller country on their border. Next time on The World, Syrians in Lebanon. What are their prospects now? Our story from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. That's next time on The World.
Tomorrow at 3 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, a new study is using AI, artificial intelligence, to figure out how to save your precious sight. For more, I spoke with Dr. McGregor Lott of Florida Eye Specialists. Hi, Dr. Lott. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, since macular degeneration is the leading cause of vision in this country, this is exciting technology to hear about. Tell us about how this new AI tech is helping people see better. What's this all about?
Well, there's a disease that we deal with called macular degeneration. It causes vision loss over time. And there's a particular type of macular degeneration called wet macular degeneration. And the earlier you treat it, the better the outcome. So figuring out a way to predict who's likely to get it and who's not is paramount. And so this latest study out of England at Moorfields Hospital has used artificial intelligence as a way to predict which patients are more likely to develop this problem. And interestingly, the artificial intelligence was better than the human doctors, even though the human doctors had more information about the patient.
why does the AI do a better job? Is it a robot scanning people's eye tissue?
Well, they looked at thousands of scans of eyes in people who had macular degeneration, and they used the characteristics of those scans to train the computer to analyze it and to use changes over time to predict who was likely to develop this problem.
So what does it say then that the human eye isn't as good as the technological eye when it comes to saving eyes, saving vision?
Well, it's very interesting. And, you know, I think this is a, you know, a harbinger of things to come. I think as more time goes by and this technology is applied to other areas, we're going to see that indeed a computer looking at minute changes is probably better than humans at detecting these small changes. And so over time, we'll probably see patient screening and to some extent decision-making made by computer technology rather than just humans, even though humans, of course, bring a warmth and a personal connection that I think a computer probably won't ever be able to do.
But how do you think this AI model will help more patients, help slow the progression of this disease so that people can keep their precious sight?
Right. So in this disease, what you have is abnormal blood vessels that start to grow underneath the retina. And they leak fluid or bleed, and they can do that quite suddenly. It's not always apparent to the patient, however, that this is going on. And the more time that elapses between the onset and the treatment, the worse the vision can be and the harder it is to get rid of the problem. So early detection can lead to earlier treatment and therefore better visual outcomes over time. And so if the computer's able to predict, you know, if you're sitting in my chair and I say you have a 90% chance of developing this problem within 6 months, then we may want to see you more frequently. We may want to emphasize to you the importance of checking your vision at home on a daily basis, all in an effort to detect this even sooner so that we can initiate treatment and hopefully over time have a better outcome for you.
What symptoms should people, especially people age 55 and older, be looking for if they're suspecting they have AMD, age-related macular degeneration?
Right. So typically people will report a general blurring of the vision over time. They sometimes, if it's the wet type of macular degeneration, will report distortion of their vision. So for instance, if they're looking at a straight line like a door jamb or a picket fence, the straight lines will look crooked. Sometimes they'll see a dark spot near the center of their vision or a gray spot. Those are all symptoms that people report.
Okay. And this AI model for diagnosing macular degeneration, when do you anticipate that to be commonly used at places like your facility, Florida Eye Specialists?
Well, a lot still needs to be done. A lot of work still needs to be done. This was essentially a pilot study. And so what they're going to do is design and execute a clinical trial later this year in which they really involve more patients, probably at multiple facilities. And that will serve to validate this model and guide future use. You know, how should we apply it? What patients work best with it and so forth. So I think it's going to be a few more years before it really becomes mainstream. But I think this is still an exciting development for all of us.
Sure. No cure for this, but you do even have a free diagnostic tool at your website people can download and print out to check their vision, yes?
That's correct. This is called an Amsler grid. It's basically, as the name suggests, a grid that you can check your vision with. You look at the center dot, and you pay attention to all these straight lines around it. They should all be there. They should be straight. Well, suppose over time you develop a distorted area with wavy lines. that could be a sign that macular degeneration is progressing or that bleeding or swelling has developed. And that would be a reason to give your doctor a call.
Okay, check it out at FloridaEyeSpecialist.com. Dr. McGregor Lott of Florida Eye Specialists, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Escape to a world of British telly on BritBox and PBS Passport when you become a supporter of WJCT. Sign up at jacksbundle.com today.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Well, nine Duval County schools are in the midst of a school name change process. It's a chance for parents, students, alumni, and members of the community to give their input about all of this. Meantime, a coalition of groups is speaking out about why they believe these schools named after controversial Confederacy figures should see their names changed. One of those groups is on the line now as we speak with Wells Todd of Take 'em Down Jacks. He is going to bring us up to date on their efforts. Hi, Wells. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the process to potentially change the names of nine Duval County public schools? 549-2937. Give us a call. There will be a meeting about this tonight at Lehigh at 6 o'clock p.m. in the school auditorium. And, of course, Wells Lee is one of the schools whose name might be changed, named after the Confederate General Robert E. Lee, of course, along with a bunch of other schools which have names that bear reminders of the Confederacy. You are part of a coalition of groups that has been advocating for these names to be changed for some time, and you'll be making your voice heard at the meeting tonight. What do you plan to say?
Well, first thing, the names of these schools were given for a number of reasons, but one of them was to reassert white supremacy in the South after the overthrow of Reconstruction. So after the overthrow of Reconstruction, a lot of statues and monuments started to go up to let people know who was in charge again. Because before that, there were coalition governments of poor whites and blacks who had been freed who were doing what needed to be done to reconstruct the South, like land redistribution, public schooling, and other things. And so the landowners, of course, didn't appreciate that at all because they knew the huge plantations they had would be broken up. And so after they violently overthrew Reconstruction, they went on a wave of naming schools, raising statues and monuments. Part of that was to put fear in the black community. And then, you know, we went through this era of terror lynching for a number of years, decades. And that didn't stop until the 60s. And so basically what we're saying is we need to correct history, and we need to remove the names of these people who did damage to Africans, African Americans, and to the indigenous population through colonialism. And tonight there'll be a meeting at Robert E. Lee at 6 p.m. and people can come and fill out a card and give their input as to why they should keep the name or why the name should be removed. Sure. One of the things that we have to understand is that, you know, the war was a treasonous war. And these people, you know, went against the government. They went and formed their own government. They had their own president and vice president. They had their own money. And so it was a crime. But if we look back at history, these generals and others that were supposed to be tried for treason, the charges were dropped. And it never happened.
Right. I just want to say your group, Take 'Em Down Jacks, along with other groups, has been successful in getting monuments and memorials to the Confederacy removed, most prominently the statue of the Confederate soldier in downtown Hemming Park, along with many others around the region. This has been also part of your goal, is to get these school name changes approved, because they are also monuments and memorials to the Confederacy.
Exactly. And we won't stop until that's done. And it's like you said, it's happening throughout the South and the North. One of the arguments about keeping statues and monuments and names is that we're trying to erase history. It's very interesting that we are trying to correct history, but not only that, when they talk about keeping names and statues,
What do you mean by correct history?
Correcting history.
What does that mean?
When we speak about the Civil War, for instance, there is this mistake that the Civil War was fought for Southern states' rights. It was fought to maintain slavery, and it was fought because the South didn't want to pay its share in taxes. We have to understand that back then, if the South itself had been a country, it would have been the third richest country in the world. That's how rich Southern planters were.
And let me, if I could, lots of calls for Wells Todd of Take 'Em Down Jacks. There will be a meeting tonight at Lee High School at 6 o'clock where the public can weigh in on a process to potentially change the name of Lee, along with a number of other schools. 549-2937. Emery is in Riverside. Emery, good morning. Go ahead, Emery. You're on the air.
I'm sorry. Good morning. I was just calling to say I have a son who attends Jackson High School, and I have several friends who teach at some of these other named schools, and nobody at the schools has any issue with this. They're all very happy about it. The only problem, you know, some of the parents are having is the cost of renaming some of the schools and changing the signs and the logos and all that stuff. But speaking to his comment earlier about Reconstruction, this is exactly what these schools were named for and exactly why these statues were put up. It was just to remind people what they had to do. And up until this last year, we considered Johnson one of the worst president in U.S. history for allowing Reconstruction to fail. And it would be like putting up a statue this week to the QAnon shaman.
Thanks, Amory. Linda on the north side. Linda, what do you think?
Oh, good morning. This is my first time calling.
Oh, thanks for calling.
I am absolutely enraged at grouping Rebalt Senior High and Rebalt Junior High among the nine schools that want to have their names changed. Jean Ribault was not a Confederate general. He did not terrorize the Indians. All he did was come from France with a group of, I think it's Huguenots, I'm not a history buff.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Come to this country to establish religious freedom. I live near the Rebalt River, do we want to change the name of this river flowing through Jacksonville? There's a Rebalt Manor. There's a Rebalt Scenic Drive. And I think it's absolutely insane to touch the name of those two schools. Thank you.
All right, Linda. Okay, Wells Todd, you know, on this program several weeks ago, we did interview a guy from Lyon, France, a direct descendant of Jean Ribault. He called into this show from across the ocean, essentially giving us the same argument, saying that Ribault shouldn't be lumped in with Confederate generals and also those who harmed Native populations, indigenous populations. What's your take?
Well, I think it's the mindset is a mindset that we find a lot of. Ribault was a colonialist. He was an invader of this land. You can't say he didn't hurt the indigenous population. He took land from them. And no matter how you cut that, you are invading a space. And you are taking land from people, and you're bringing diseases, and you're doing all kinds of other stuff. So he was no angel, you know, as they tried to portray. You know, he was an invader just like the others were invaded, just like, you know, the English that came over here to begin with and, committed atrocities against the indigenous population. So, you know, I think it's really strange that we honor people who hurt and harmed the indigenous population and the Africans who were enslaved here. Because what it shows is that it doesn't matter if you kill people of color. We'll honor you anyway. And I think that's a dangerous position that this country is in right now. And I think it was reflected with 4 years of Trump saying that the statues should stay up and the names should stay on the forts. We're not actually trying to deal with racism, institutionalized racism in this country. And the other thing is, history should be taught in school. And what I mean by that is you cannot teach history by putting up a statue. And those statues were not put up. And the names were not put on those schools to teach history. They were put up and put on the schools to reaffirm white supremacy in this country. The Daughters of the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
And we're a minute from the break. So let me just jump in and say, if you want to add your voice to this, come on out to Robert E. Lee High School at 6 o'clock tonight. There will be an open public meeting about this subject. And I want to thank you, Wells Todd of Take 'Em Down Jacks, part of a coalition of groups advocating for these school name changes. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Melissa.
A quick break. And when we come back after a rough year for the food and beverage business throughout the pandemic, some positive news, how you can enjoy some outdoor dining way up high in downtown Jacksonville. That's after this.
The Kingsley Plantation and the Fort Caroline National Memorial are both located in the Timucuan Ecological and Historic Preserve. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will visit the National Park. We'll discuss Black History Museums in Florida and endangered historic buildings in Jacksonville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
With COVID-19, stock market volatility, and a recession in the offing, the news right now can be unsettling to say the least. But during these disquieting times, Marketplace remains committed to bringing you necessary daily economic context. So please join me, Kai Rizdahl, every weekday to make sense of what's going on in U.S. markets and in the global economy.
Tomorrow night at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9. On the next Fresh Air, we speak with Deborah Feldman, whose memoir about leaving the ultra-Orthodox Satmar Hasidic community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, inspired the Netflix series Unorthodox. Feldman will explain why she felt she had to leave her arranged marriage and the price she paid for breaking with the sect. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Many states are looking to pass new laws that will impact the transgender community. Some would restrict gender-affirming health care for young Americans. Others target transgender students' participation in organized sports. LGBTQ advocates say it's an organized assault by conservative groups. Those backing these measures disagree. Trans, teens, and the fight over health care and more. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, after a very rough year for the food and beverage industry, we are so excited to share some positive news with everyone today. Not one, but two new restaurants are opening up in downtown Jacksonville, and one of them gives you a bird's eye view. Dwayne Belyakov is co-founder of The Bread and Board and the new Estrella Cochina, and he's on the line now. Hey, Dwayne, good morning. Oh, sorry. Let me get you on the line there. I forgot to press a button. Hi, Dwayne. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. So good to talk to you. And this is exciting. Now, I'm a big fan of the Bread and Board, which is a restaurant you've had open over in the Five Points area for some time. You're going to be bringing that Bread and Board brand into the ground floor of the Vistar building downtown, which is exciting enough. But there's more news. You're actually also going to be going way up on the rooftop of Vistar and opening up a rooftop bar and restaurant, Estrella Cochina. This sounds amazing. Tell us what we can expect.
Well, thanks again for having us on. We're super excited, and you're right. It's been a challenging year for so many people, and I feel like we're coming out of it finally ourselves. And this project is really inspired us to kind of push through. But we have been, I myself am an avid scuba diver, was until I had kids, and we got we had the ability to travel to lots of western parts of Mexico, small towns, over the years and do some dive trips. And we were really inspired by the simple coastal seafood in many of these towns. And we felt there was quite the parallel between our, coastal community here in Jacksonville and many of the towns that we would travel to. So we set the task on designing a very simple, fresh take on Mexican cuisine, our take on it, inspired by those travels and those meals that we would have in many of the fondas or family restaurants that line the coast. So kind of in a creative partnership with Brian Wolfberg, who really wanted something unique.
And he's the CEO of Vistar, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. And kind of a new visionary for downtown Jacksonville, as you know, really wanting to transform not just the Laura Street corridor there along with DIA, but really to try and pull people back to enjoying the benefits and assets of downtown Jacksonville. So
this will be sited.
That's where this all started for us.
This is great. This will be sited on the 7th floor of the Vistar Tower. The address is 100 West Bay Street. People will be able to take the elevator up to the 7th floor. You'll have both indoor and outdoor rooftop space. Going to have amazing wraparound views of the city, the river, amazing Baja coastal Mexican food, as you said. And, you know, this adds to what I think has been a huge lack in the urban core, rooftop bars and rooftop dining. We've been very slow in Jacksonville to get into this concept, but it's finally here with a vengeance, and this is the newest addition.
Yeah, I mean, there are some trailblazers in this area, of course, River and Post over by our original Riverside location and Cowper Chop House both have beautiful rooftops, gorgeous views of downtown. Our view is quite unique in that it really does stretch from looking all the way up the north corridor of Laura Street towards the Museum of Modern Art. You see the Dames Point Bridge. You can see all the way down to Daly Center and then across the river to South Bank. So it's really a sweeping view. And we're surrounded by a 5-foot glass wall all the way around the surround. So it's really unobstructed. And, of course, looking straight up at the Wells Fargo and the Vistar Towers.
It sounds great. And now, as I said, you'll also be opening a bread and board marketplace on the ground floor of the Vistar Tower with some dining and some products for sale. So with all of this activity, you're going to be hiring. So people need to apply for jobs, which is so exciting to be able to report.
Yeah, we're excited about it. It's going to be quite the undertaking. We have about 85 to 90 employees that we will need to bring on board, and we will also, of course, be hiring for our other locations at Town Center and Riverside. But between the two, the ground floor and the rooftop, we're going to hold a job fair in the coming weeks, probably the next 2 weeks. Hopefully do it on the rooftop since we're furnished and ready to go up there. And folks will get to experience exactly what the restaurant will be like. So we're going to be announcing that on our social media. We're also partnering with Downtown Vision. They will be announcing it on their website and social media platforms, and we encourage people to come down. It really is all skill levels, both in the kitchen and in the front of house, and looking to put together a really stellar team to bring this to life.
So follow Estrella Cochina on your Instagram, your Twitter, all social media. Look for this announcement, and we will look, Duane, for you guys to be opening up later this spring.
Absolutely. We're shooting to have both restaurants open in and around May 1st, if all goes well.
Very exciting. Duane Beliakoff, co-founder of The Bread and Board and the new Estrella Cochina. Best of luck, and thanks so much, Duane. We can't wait to see it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us on.
How about that? Some positive news and some new jobs. Very, very exciting. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming. Send your feedback to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast is up today wherever you like to listen. You can always listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.